Does Paul Forbid Women from Teaching? Part 2 was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 10, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A translation of 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11 to chapter 3, verse 1a by Jack Crabtree accompanies this talk.
Last week we started a series on answering the question, does Paul forbid women to teach? And in this day and age, that sounds like an incredibly bizarre question. But the reason that's an important question and has been an important question for me is that the tradition that I kind of came out of, basically evangelical Protestantism, there are a number of people within that tradition who answer that question, yes, Paul does forbid a woman to teach. And the reason for that is because of a passage in 1 Timothy 2. To understand that passage, we have to go back to the Genesis account, and that's what we did last week. We're going to hit the 1 Timothy 2 passage this week. Just to highlight why this is an issue. Jody and I were listening to a talk that Dennis Prager was giving at Yeshiva University. Dennis Prager identifies himself as an Orthodox Jew with a small O. It was a very fascinating speech, but right up front, one of the things that he said was interesting. So he said, I never ask anybody anymore whether they believe in God, because that in this day and age has become basically meaningless. All kinds of people claim to believe in God, but when you get into the thick of it, the God that they believe in is themselves. So he says, what I ask people is, do you believe in any text that God has given to you? Do you believe there's any text that you must have rule your life and govern your life because that text is from God? That has been the basis for my life for decades now, because what I became convinced of when I was in college is that the Bible is the absolutely authoritative, inerrant Word of God, and this is God's revelation to us, and we need to take it with the utmost seriousness and have it guide our lives. I felt a lot of simpatico with Dennis Prager and what he was saying, because that's basically the point that he was making. But that leaves you with some problems every now and then, and this is one of them. I'll read the passage that is so problematic. Well, I'm going to read the whole chapter, starting with chapter 2, verse 1. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. By the way, I will have all kinds of objections, some of which I will raise, most of them I will not, to the translation here. I think this doesn't tell us what Paul is saying with as straightforwardly as I would hope. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God, and one mediator also between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all, the testimony given at the proper time. For this I was appointed a preacher and an apostle. I am telling the truth, I am not lying, as a teacher of the Gentiles in faith and truth. Therefore I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. But women will be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. It is a trustworthy statement. Okay, I was reading there out of the New American Standard Version. If you printed it off from the internet, then you got my translation of part of that, which is a little bit different. But the problematic passage, of course, is verse 12. I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. And there are significant numbers of Christians in various Christian traditions who have understood Paul to be saying, women are not to play the role of a teacher of the Bible, a pastor. They are not to be an elder. They are not to have authority in any given community. I didn't know what else to do with it, so I just sort of accepted that perspective for decades now. It wasn't until recently in studying Genesis that I began to revisit what it was that Paul was saying here. And I think I have a better grasp of it, and that's what I want to talk about tonight. First of all, let's get a fix on the context here. At first impression, starting with 2:1, it sounds like he's talking about prayer. Then he's talking about how he wants Christian women to dress. And then he's talking about how he doesn't want women to teach. And I have always taken it to be, and it kind of sounds like he's saying, the structure of God's created reality is such that you are violating the order and structure of created reality if women have authority over men and teach men. That's what it kind of sounds like. So, pray, doesn't tell us what to pray for, but pray and pray for your governing leaders. Women, dress modestly and shut up. So that's kind of the first impression that you get. I think to understand what Paul is saying here, we have to go back to verse 118. He's after saying a bunch of other things in the introduction, he finally gets around to 118 and says, "This command I entrust to you, Timothy, my son, in accordance with the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you fight the good fight." And then when you drop down to 2:1, for chapter 2, verse 1, first of all then, what's that first of all? I think this is the first item that's a part of the command that he's entrusting to him. I think that's the way to understand what he's doing here. So, why is this important? In previous to 118, he's talked about false teachers, people departing from the faith. They had been proteges of one kind or another of Paul, evidently, but had, as he puts it, become shipwrecked. They have departed from the faith and are no longer faithful to the gospel. There are a lot of commentators who carry that theme into this section that we're looking at. And essentially what they end up saying is what Paul forbids is for women to teach heresy. Well, of course he does, but he would forbid anybody from teaching heresy. I mean, that's not distinctive to women. So that's not his point. That can't be his point. And besides, he's made a break with all of his discussion about the false teachers who've fallen away and stuff. He's beginning the main body of the letter at verse 18. "This command I entrust to you, Timothy." I'm going to now get into the meat of what I want to tell you. And then when he gets to 2:1, the first item on that is, okay, I would argue that that first item goes all the way to chapter 3, verse 1, the latter half, where he starts, if any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. And he's talking about now this role of what he called, of what New American Standard translates as overseer. Everything else before that is all of a piece. It's basically making the one single point that he wants to stress to Timothy. You need to promote this among the people that you're teaching. Well, what is that one thing that he wants to promote? Well, as it happens, it's relatively it stands out if we don't get distracted by, oh, he's talking about prayer and he's talking about clothes and he's talking about teaching. If we don't let ourselves get distracted by that, there's a very striking fact about this passage. There are four words that are very rarely used in the New Testament that are all used in this passage. And it's no accident that they are occurring in this passage several times in the passage, and yet you don't see them anywhere else, because they are the point that Paul is making. The words are hemeros, hesukia or hesukios, and sophrosune. Those three or four words, depending upon how you count words, are one of them. This is the only place it occurs. Another one, it occurs twice out of the four times that it occurs in the Bible, twice here. Another one occurs twice in the Bible, once here. And another one, two out of three times it occurs are in this passage. So whatever these are talking about, hesukia, sophrosune, hemeros, that's the point that he's making. And what's interesting is that they don't occur just in connection with what he wants from the women. They also occur with what he wants from the men. So there's no distinction between men and women with respect to, well, I shouldn't say there's no distinction. There's a distinction with respect to how this is going to manifest itself, but what he wants to have manifest is the same for men and for women. Well, what is it? I would argue that it's the one thing he wants is an inward spirit of calm, non-restiveness, acceptance of one's lot in life, of who one is and what God has given them to do, and a submission to the will of God. You know, there's basically two ways we can respond to our lives. We can be dissatisfied, discontent, and struggling with it, pounding against the boundaries of our life and the walls of our life, wanting out. I want to be different. I want to do something different. I don't like where I am. I don't like my circumstances. I don't like me. I want out. Give me a new life. That, now, it may not be quite that extreme, but headed in that direction is one way we can respond. Or the other way we can respond is with this sort of grateful recognition that I'm a creature of God. God made me, is making me, and he's making me in accordance with his purposes and his will, and that's why I'm here, is to accomplish his purposes and his will. And so instead of bitching about it and complaining about it, I just need to sit back and watch and see what God is going to do with me. What is my story going to be? What is my existence going to be? And I accept it with calm and, I guess that's the best word, calm and submission to who God is and what his will is. That's the first point that he wants to make. And he's saying, I want the men to be like that, and I want the women to be like that. Okay, so this stuff about prayer, let's look at this a little bit more carefully with speaking about the men. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions, and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil, not sure about that translation, but that's one of those words, a tranquil and quiet, that's the other word. The quiet, though, is not outward quiet, it's inward quiet. That's I want them to live a tranquil and inwardly quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Now, what's the opposite of tranquil and quiet? Well, we see if we go down to verse 8. Therefore, he wraps this whole section up, therefore, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension. What's the opposite of tranquil and quiet? Rage, anger, the discontent that leads to this, that fuels this anger that is so much a constant in many men's lives. And dissension, which manifests itself in the kind of lashing out at one group or another. And we fight and we compete because I'm not happy and damn it, I just want to fight. That kind of rage. That's the main point he's making. So why all this stuff about prayer and particularly praying for kings and all who are in authority? Well, where does our rage mostly manifest itself? Doesn't it mostly manifest itself against those people who have power over our lives, who have authority over our lives, whose decisions and who they are and what they do and what they value and what they want actually impinges on my life in a significant way? They're part of the boundaries of my life that I'm not liking. I'm not much liking what they're doing, and so I lash out. I mean, look at how often we in America, for example, have evidenced real hatred for the president or the congressman or the governor or any number of people who we don't approve of their decisions and what they're doing, but what is our response? It's hatred. It's rage. Irrational, blind opposition. I think that's the dissension he's talking about. So notice what he's saying is instead of raging against your king, pray for him. And what is the prayer? The prayer is that God might have mercy upon him and save him. That's why you have that kind of parenthetical section about the gospel of salvation through the one mediator, Jesus Christ. Why is that even relevant to what he's saying here? Well, because God's will, when he sent his son into the world, is to provide the basis for God showing mercy to everyone. And God isn't making any distinctions. The offer of salvation is an open invitation to everyone, no matter how much you might hate them, no matter how much of a jerk they are, no matter how much your enemy they might be. Instead of plotting against them and wishing the worst and wishing their downfall, pray that God might actually save their soul and give them eternal life. I mean, what an incredible opposition that is. So this is not about prayer. You know, we can't draw principles of if we would just pray, our history would go differently. That's not what he's saying. He's concerned about us. What is your attitude? What do you want? Do your desires line up with God, God's desires, the Creator's desires? He has loved. We must love with the same kind of love that he loved. And what's likely to interfere with that? That rage that settles in because we are unable and unwilling to accept from God the life that he has given me, the who I am, the what I am, and what he has given me to do. Okay, so when it comes to women, I'm going to argue, we'll look at that in a second, he's basically saying the same thing, but what's the most important authority that a woman has to deal with? Her cotton-picking husband. And so what he's calling upon the woman to do is to have that same spirit of acceptance, quietness, what he calls tranquility, but that quietness of spirit in relationship to the authority in her life because of her marriage. So we'll get there, but do you see the continuity? That's the one thing. That's the first thing that he wants Timothy to impart to the people he's teaching. Okay, now the thing about clothes, partly we have a translation problem here because I think the translators think that he's talking about clothes. He's not talking about how a woman should dress. He's talking about how a woman should adorn herself. And what he's saying is a woman should adorn herself with sophrosune, idous, and good works. Okay, well, what are these? Idous, I don't know how to translate it. Idos, I believe, means, I mean, it's something like shame, but obviously there's a kind of shame that's just pathological. You know, we shouldn't be ashamed of ourselves, pathologically ashamed of ourselves. But each and every one of us should have the humility to realize when all is said and done, I'm an unworthy person. I'm an unworthy creature. My lives, my action, every part of who I am is tainted by the evil and perversity that's a part of just every human being. And so I really have no basis to get kind of uppity and out there and to live shamelessly. I have no basis for living shamelessly. So I think the opposite of eidos here, it's translated modestly in the New American Standard Translation as if it's referring to the kind of clothing to wear, but I think that's a mistake. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing or with clothing that really adorns them, and he's speaking metaphorically. Well, how are you supposed to adorn yourself? With eidos, with whatever the opposite of shamelessness is. Don't conduct your life in such a way that you make choices and behave shamelessly. Be self-controlled enough to not do what a human being ought not to do. Don't be shameless. And with sophrosune. Well, what is sophrosune? I think the very nature and essence of sophrosune is accepting your lot in life, accepting who you are and what God has given you to do, what your role is. Just the acceptance of that is sophrosune. I'm not sure how to translate that easily. So, women, don't adorn yourself with braided hair, gold, silver, precious stones, costly garments. Don't make your adornment be your outward physical adornment. Make your adornment be the moral virtues that you practice. So he's not really telling us anything about fashion. He's telling us, skip all that, never mind all that. Let's go right to the heart of what makes a beautiful woman a beautiful woman. It's the inward spirit of, as he puts it at the end, of who adorns herself with good works. By being a good person, she becomes a beautiful person. Okay. So he's not really talking about clothes. Once again, he's talking about who are you inwardly? What is your inward attitude? Now he's going to apply that. What kind of good work in particular are we talking about here? Well, the same thing that should characterize your husbands, the men. And now we get to 2:11. A woman must quietly receive instruction. I'm gonna move over now to my translation if you have that. A wife in Heisukiya is to receive instruction with complete subordination. I do not permit a wife to give instructions to and impose her will on her husband. Rather, she is to be in Heisukiya. All right. Because our English translations translate it, a wife is to learn in quietness with complete subordination. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over her husband. It's that translation that leads us to the conclusion that he's talking about your role in the church or in society or whatever. But there's several mistakes that have been made in reading this account. One of the important ones is he's not talking about men and women here. It's not a woman is to learn, it's a wife is to receive instruction. The word in Greek can be used for a woman, or it can be used for a wife. It doesn't clearly make a distinction. It depends on the context. In their time and place, there wasn't usually much of a distinction, because if you were a woman, you were likely married in that culture. They didn't live in our culture where we have a significant population of unmarried single people. They got married. In fact, it was for legally and socially and in all other respects, it was very important for a woman to be married because that was her protection from being harmed and being ripped off and being dealt with unjustly, victimized in a variety of ways. So most of them were married. That's why the word doesn't really distinguish between a woman and a wife, because most women are wives. But we're going to see that what's critical to Paul's point is that she be a wife. It's not her femaleness that is the issue. It's her wifeliness that is the issue. She's in a particular relationship with a particular set of commitments and obligations that go with that. And that's what makes the point that he's making. So a wife in Heisukiya, okay, what is Heisukiya? It's that kind of, they translated it earlier as quiet, and here in the New American Standard translates it, a woman must quietly receive instruction. It's this inward calm that comes from accepting who you are and accepting what place in life God has given you. If you have that kind of calm, then that's Heisukiya. A wife in Heisukiya is to receive instruction, not learn. To our ears, in our idiom, when we read learn, we think that we're talking about somebody is instructing us in wisdom, knowledge, understanding, and from our perspective, where does that come from except the scriptures? So somebody is teaching the scriptures and teaching us wisdom and understanding and knowledge from the scriptures. And so he's telling a woman that she's supposed to sit under that teaching quietly. And by quietly, we usually translate that to don't ask any questions, don't make any comments, just shut up and be a woman. I mean, that the worst case scenario, that's how people read it. But this passage is not talking about that kind of learning or that kind of teaching. It's not talking about teaching the Bible or learning the Bible. It's talking about a marriage relationship between a husband and a wife who have a particular set of decisions that they need to make. What are we going to do? We're not choosing for mankind. We're not universalizing this. We're wanting to decide what we in particular are going to do. Where are we going to live? What house are we going to buy? How are we going to raise our kids? What values are we going to impart to our kids? Blah, all right on down the line. The particular kinds of things that make our lives what our lives are as a married couple. The instructions that he's talking about are receiving instructions from the husband. Not instructions in wisdom, knowledge, and understanding, but instructions about what we're going to do today or this month or this year. I mean, we use it that way. If the foreman shows up on the job site, he instructs his employees as to what their task is for the day. He instructs them, right? That's more what we need to think of than somebody standing up here and teaching the Bible. That's not the teaching we're talking about. That's not the instruction we're talking about. So a wife, in acceptance of who she is to receive instruction from her husband with complete subordination or submission. That is, she's to accept her place in the marriage relationship. She's the wife, he's the husband. In Heisukia, acceptance of the structure and logic of that relationship, instead of rebelling against it or balking at it or resisting it, she's supposed to calmly accept it and therefore be willing to take instructions from her husband. Now, this, of course, rubs us the wrong way in our modern culture. I mean, this rubs us the wrong way. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we have a right? you have to remember that Paul also wrote Ephesians, is it 5 or 6? Ephesians, somewhere. And he talks about husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And how did he love it? We mentioned this last week in connection with the Genesis account. He loved it as his own body. Husbands are to love their wives as their own bodies. No husband despises his own body, but he cares for it and he nurtures it. Well, she is to be viewed as one body with you, husband. You must be just as committed to her well-being as you are your own body's well-being. That's what marriage is. That's who she is to you. So love her with that kind of care, that kind of tenderness, and that kind of commitment. So let's keep that in mind as we hear Paul here. He's not talking about that in this passage, but we know from Ephesians that's clearly his perspective. In this perspective here, he's simply talking about a kind of priority that the husband has to the wife, and he's telling the wives, instead of rebelling against that, respect that. Respect that priority that God has given to the husband. We can talk more about that in a second, but that's what he's saying when he says a wife in Heisukia is to receive instruction from her husband with complete subordination. I do not permit a wife to give instructions to and impose her own will on her husband. In other words, I don't permit the role reversal. It's partly a role reversal, although I think the second word that I translate to impose her own will on her husband, I don't think he would even allow a husband to do that, to impose his will on his wife. But the first part would be a role reversal for a wife to give instructions to her husband. She's not the head of the relationship. He is the head of the relationship. So I don't permit a role reversal there. Now, what I've translated, and impose her own will on her husband, that word occurs only once in the New Testament. That's here. I don't know how far to get into this, but the word in some context means murder. but the basic fundamental idea of the word is authenteo. It comes from the Greek word for self. So it's taking myself and doing something with myself in relationship to other people. So that's why I think the basic idea here is to take my own self's will and impose it on another. In this case, it's the wife to the husband, imposing her own self's will on her husband. Now, why do I take it that way? The next thing that Paul is going to do is to quote some kind of prefabricated, preformulated statement. And in mine, I have it set apart. Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but his wife being completely deceived, he happened into transgression, but he will be saved through childbearing if they persist in belief and love and sanctifiedness with Sophrosune. And then he adds, this statement is reliable. Now, some of your English translations have this statement is reliable as connected with the next part of what he says and referring to what follows. No, I don't think so. What follows doesn't sound like a statement at all. At least it's certainly not a very memorable statement or a very significant statement. But this has all the earmarks of a statement, this part that I've highlighted. It's cryptic, it's brief, it's very dense, it teases you, you need to think about it and figure out what's going on, what's being said. I think that's what he's calling the statement. So we need to unpack that statement. Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but his wife being completely deceived, he happened into transgression. But he will be saved through childbearing if they persist in belief and love and sanctifiedness. And actually, I think the statement ends there, in my estimation, and then Paul just tacks on with Sophrosune, because that fits the context of the point that he's making here. Okay, let's take it apart. Adam was formed first, and then Eve. Well, everything in the statement invites us to go back and know everything we can know from Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. It's not the fact that Adam was formed first and then Eve that he's relying upon. It's the story of the creation of Eve in Genesis 2. And this is just a shorthand, just a kind of a hook to remind us of that story. Because what is the story? The story was God created Adam out of the dust of the ground, and he put him in the garden, and he gave him instructions in the garden. He instructed him of what he could eat and what he couldn't eat. He put him in the garden with the task of cultivating the garden. He has responsibilities. And after we don't know how much time, God says, you know, it's not good for Adam to be alone. I'm going to make an etzer corresponding to him. I'm going to give him an equal counterpart to help him with his life and his task and his role and so on. I'm going to make a helper who corresponds to him. So then God takes from Adam's side and out of that chunk of flesh from his side creates Eve. Well, all of that is intended to be brought to mind by what Paul is saying here. That's what Adam was formed first and then Eve means. Well, what are the implications of that? Well, we know from other letters like 1 Corinthians and so on that Paul links the fact that Adam was there and created and Eve only came afterwards as the basis for judging Adam to be the head in the relationship. And by head, think the primary member of the relationship. Head in that sense. Adam was the primary member of the marriage relationship. Eve was given as an etzer to him, a helper to him. All right. Well, already we have a piece of information that supports what he has just said. Why should a wife in Heisukia receive instruction with complete subordination? Why does Paul not permit a wife to give instructions or to impose her own will on her husband? Because if, in fact, as Paul is assuming, the first marriage of Adam and Eve was a prototypical marriage, then we can look at that relationship and realize that just as Adam was the head of Eve in that relationship, the husband is the head of his wife in every other marriage relationship to follow. That's how Paul's thinking about this. So, because Adam was formed first and then Eve, it makes sense that that priority translates into a certain distinctive set of roles. One is the helper and one is the head. And it's Adam who's the head and the wife who's the helper. All right, next thing he says. And Adam was not deceived, but his wife being completely deceived, he happened into transgression. Now, I'm translating this slightly differently. I don't think it really matters how you end up translating this or analyzing this. It comes to the same thing either way. But I prefer his wife being completely deceived being a kind of standalone clause here. So that the main clause is, and Adam was not deceived, but he happened into transgression. So what is he getting at? Well, think back, he says, to what happened in the garden. What happened in the garden is Ha-Nakash, Satan, came to Eve and completely and utterly deceived her. Deceived her so completely, if I'm right about the way I understand that passage, deceived her so completely that she thought she was doing something that would be pleasing to God when in fact it was displeasing to God. And then what does the text say? And then she gave to her husband with her and he ate. Every husband, I think, can feel for Adam in this situation. Look at the impossible situation that he ended up being in. His wife comes to him, and I don't know what she said. I don't know what she communicated. The text doesn't tell us. It doesn't seem to care. But his wife came to him and said, I ate. You want to eat too? I think you should eat too. Probably still being deceived, thinking that we're going to do something pleasing to God if we do this. So Adam, you should eat too. Now Adam is not deceived, Paul says. Adam was not deceived. So Adam was in a situation where I can displease my wife or I can displease God, but I know good and well what I'm doing. If I eat, I know I'm displeasing God. I'm not faked out. He told me not to do it, so I'm going to have to choose to do what God told me not to do. On the other hand, if I don't eat, my wife's going to be displeased. Eve never should have done that. No woman should ever put her husband in a position of, you need to choose me or God, dude. Me or God. If you're going to be a helper, you're going to help your husband choose to obey God. But alas, women, just like men, are evil beings, are evil creatures. And because women are evil creatures, because wives are evil creatures, there is a tendency for them to want, remember what God told Eve in the garden? Your desire will be for your husband, but he will dominate you. And as I suggested last week, your desire will be for your husband is, just like God said to Cain before he killed Abel, sin's desire is for you. That is, it's an idiom for sin wants to master you and control you and get out of you what it wants to get out of you. So the woman having a desire for her husband is an idiom for your wife is going to want to control you and get out of you what she wants to get out of you. That's not her femaleness. That's her sinfulness manifesting itself. It's not her femaleness. But because she's a sinful being, she's going to want to control you. That's what Eve was doing. Eve was giving instructions to Adam. Adam, yeah, try this, man. So she was giving instructions to Adam, and remember what God blamed Adam for? Adam, because you obeyed the voice of your wife, and ate from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from, cursed is the ground because of you. It's because you listened to the voice of your wife. Well, not because she's his wife, but because your wife was being evil and was asking you to make a choice between obeying me and pleasing her, and you chose her. You listened to the voice of your wife over me. Cursed is the ground because of you. So I think Paul is quoting this because he sees a real parallel between what Eve actually did and what he is instructing the wives not to do. Don't be like Eve was. I do not permit a wife to give instructions to and impose her own will on her husband. Now, the two go together. It's give instructions that would impose your will on your husband. That's what I don't allow you to do. It's fine to ask the husband to take out the garbage if God doesn't object. But it's not okay to give instructions that pit your will against the will of God, the Creator. Okay, so Adam was not deceived, but his wife being completely deceived, he happened into transgression. So sin entered the world through Eve as she imposed her will on Adam. Adam was the first one to transgress, but Eve was the entry point for sin into the world. You see the distinction? Adam was the first one to transgress because he made a deliberate and conscious and was fully aware of the choice he was making, and he chose not to obey God, but to obey the voice of his wife instead. So that was a full-throated transgression. Eve was deceived. But she was deceived by the evil one who tricked her into thinking that good was evil and evil was good. Okay, the next part of it, but he will be saved through childbearing. That most translations think they're talking about Eve here. But I think each and every one of these statements is a statement about Adam. Adam was formed first and then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but his wife being completely deceived, he happened into transgression. But he, Adam, will be saved through childbearing. Okay. I'm not going to take the time to get into all the intricacies of this. I think this could be derived from Genesis, because I'm arguing that the whole purpose of this statement was to be a brief digestion of the ultimate purposes of God, as can be seen directly and immediately right at the beginning from Genesis 2 and 3. And I think that was the purpose of the statement that he's quoting. And so he quotes it here because it has so much bearing on the point, on his exhortation to women. So he will be saved through childbearing. There are two senses in which that's true. Ultimately, I think what he has in mind is through the birth of the Messiah, Jesus. So look at the wonderful kind of ironic symmetry in God's plans. God so scripted it that sin entered the world through the woman, but he also so scripted it that there ain't no salvation for nobody except for the woman. That is, the female member of humanity is the one that was the entry point for sin, but the female member of humanity is also the entry point for salvation in the world. It's kind of a delicious sort of irony there. Because if the Messiah, in the gospel, salvation fully and completely and without qualification hinges on this person, Jesus, who had to be born of the woman, enter into history, and play the role that he did and be who he was in order that any of us might be saved at all. So how does Adam get his salvation? From the transgression, the guilt and condemnation that was attached to the transgression. He gets it through the bearing of the Messiah, through the childbearing. Now, I won't get into this here, but I think that could be established from Genesis 2 and 3. Eve, I'm going to put enmity between you and the serpent, and between your seed and his seed. He, which I don't think is Jesus yet, but the children of God and the children of the devil, you will crush his head. It will crush his head. Your seed, Eve, will crush its head, and he will bruise it on the heel. So, and then later, he calls Eve the mother. Adam names her the mother of all living. Eve, because she's the mother of all living, all who will receive life. How is she the mother of all who will receive life? Really, basically, in two senses. She's going to give birth to a human being through a line of human beings, that's going to ultimately end up with the Messiah coming into existence, and he's the one who is going to provide life to all of mankind. And then furthermore, who are the ones who are the children of Eve? The ones who have her, who will receive mercy as she will receive mercy. Eve is the mother of that line of that line of human individuals who are going to receive mercy and eternal life from God. But what is that based upon? The one who's going to die because Satan is going to bruise that seed on the heel. And I think that's probably a direct reference to the crucifixion. If they persist in belief and love and sanctifiedness, that's just the standard doctrine that gets taught everywhere in the New Testament. Who are the people who are going to be saved? The people who have hearts that are open and receptive to the truth about Jesus, the Messiah. And we respond to the truth about him by believing it. And love. We have a love of God and his purposes and his values and his righteousness and so on. They persist in belief and the right kind of love and sanctifiedness, that is, those qualities that set us apart as different from every other human being on the planet. We march to the beat of a different drum because the Spirit of God has invaded us and begun to transform us inwardly so that who we were before, we are no longer. We want different wants. We think different thoughts. We believe different things. We perceive life differently. Why? Because God is giving us eyes to see and ears to hear the truth. And why is that true? Because God's at work to sanctify us, to set us apart, make us distinctive as people who have a destiny in being rescued from death into life. And then I think Paul just tacks on to the saying, with sophrosune. So what's the part of sanctifiedness that is the whole point of this section? That we be people who, on the inside, are quite ready and willing to accept who we are and what God has given us to do. We don't fight it. We don't resist it. We don't, we don't rebel against it. We just gratefully accept who God has made us to be. And then he just adds, this statement is reliable. Okay, so bottom line, this has nothing to do with women teaching. Nothing. That's not the issue. The issue is wives and their relationship to their husbands in the specific passages that people often look to. And it's not about, it's not saying you can't, you know, wives, if you know something about the Bible, don't you dare share that with your husband. Just shut up. You're not supposed to teach your husband. He's not saying that. Of course, any of us can teach anybody about wisdom and understanding and knowledge. It would be evil not to. Of course we have to teach each other. And our sex should be completely irrelevant to that. But there is this issue of the special relationship that God has created, this relationship called marriage, that has a certain structure to it and a certain order to it. There's a whole lot more we could say about that, and maybe in responding to some questions I can do that. But with respect to the question that I set out to answer, that's a whole different matter from whether women can teach in society and in the church and so on. So he's really not saying anything different here from what he does in other passages. The husband is the head. Wives are to be subordinate to their husbands, just like the scripture says. That's all he's saying here, I think, in a particular application, in a particular context. Okay, we have about 10 minutes for any questions you have.
I just wanted to clarify something. Mm-hmm. The way you described giving instruction in 11 and 12 was a little different than the way you described it in what happened to between Adam and Eve. I mean, the way you described it with Eve is, okay, she could ask him to take out the garbage, but she wasn't supposed to be telling him, listen to me or God. But I wouldn't think that that has anything to do with headship. That is, if things had been reversed and Adam had eaten first and he went to Eve, I mean, if he had been deceived and he'd gone to her and said, you know, I think you ought to do this, and he wouldn't be supposed to do that either, right?
Right, right.
So
yeah, no, I don't think that has anything to do with headship.
Yeah. Right. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, you were saying that the Adam and Eve picture was kind of like what he was describing, but I'm not quite sure how it's, because it seemed like the issue was more the headship question in 11 and 12. Or maybe I'm just missing something. Is my question clear?
11 and 12. So just say that last thing again.
Well, especially 12. I mean, in my translation it says, I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet.
Right.
Now, I don't have your... Presumably it's okay for the husband to give her instruction, but she's not to give him instruction, whatever that means.
Right, right.
What I'm saying in the Adam and Eve thing, it wouldn't have been right for him to do that thing that she did,
right?
Just as much as it wouldn't have. So what's the connection? Why is okay. The Adam and Eve thing a model for that?
Okay. Well, all you would need is the statement, all you would really need to establish his point would be the first one. Adam was formed first, then Eve, period. That would have been enough. But I think the reason he quotes the whole thing is because it's already prepackaged, precomposed, available, and given to him. Timothy's aware of it. Paul knows it. He just quotes it. He just cites the whole thing. It's not like the last part about Adam being saved through childbearing has absolutely nothing to do with whether a woman should be should give instruction to her husband or not. It has nothing to do with it. So there's all kinds of superfluous stuff in the statement, but it's superfluous because it wasn't written to answer this question. It was written to kind of recapitulate what Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 have to say about the purposes of God. I mean, that was its purpose. So, of course, there's going to be all kinds of stuff in there that's not really relevant to his point. I was just pointing out how apt the part about Adam being deceived and so on, and I think it wasn't lost on Paul, how apt that was as an illustration of how it could go. But I don't think he's making an argument. I don't think he's saying, because Adam was deceived and the woman was not, you, several centuries later, shouldn't be giving instructions to your husband. That doesn't even follow. That doesn't even make any sense. But I think he's just saying, let me give you an example. I think he's just recognizing that we have in here an example of a wife giving instructions to her husband, and it didn't turn out all that well. But I don't think he's arguing from that. That wouldn't make any sense. I don't think he's saying, therefore, I don't want any woman anywhere to give instructions to her husband.
Okay, so if I'm following you, the way you're taking it does depend a lot on your seeing that as a kind of a pre-existing little
right.
formula that he's
right.
using. He's got the whole formula, but he has specific things that he's pulling out of it.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And that's why I think it's critical that he says this statement is reliable and that applies to this part, because that's my evidence that that's how he's looking at that.
Great, thanks.
In the Genesis passage where Adam calls his wife Eve the mother of all living, and then God says, your seed or it will crush his. Does that mean at that point she's repentant? If she is an example of the godly line?
I don't think it necessarily means that at that point she's repentant, but it means, because God's making a prediction. But if it's consistent with everything else the Bible teaches, at some point she will become repentant. Yeah, I would think so. So it wouldn't be consistent with the biblical teaching for someone to receive mercy without being repentant, I don't think.
So up until the time that Eve presents Adam with the fruit, you've suggested that she is completely deceived, and she didn't know that she was displeasing God, that she thought that perhaps she was actually pleasing him. But then you characterize her as telling Adam to choose between me and between God.
Yeah, I don't think she would have consciously framed it that way.
Okay.
What was really happening, but I don't think she would have herself characterized it that way.
Okay, and so then when Paul says you shouldn't do that, what Eve did, it's not that she was consciously doing that.
Right, right.
Okay, thanks.
How much tweaking or adjusting do you have to do to the marriage relationship from the difference of the culture during that time and the culture that we live in now? A woman in those days was dependent on the marriage relationship for protection, for just survival and whatever. That is not the case necessarily now.
Mm-hmm.
So is there, you reach a point somewhere in the marriage down the line where a decision has to be made if you don't agree or whatever. But how does that shake? I mean, looking at the difference in the cultural situations between then and now, you have a comment on that or how?
Yeah, I probably have more comments than I can remember. Let me comment first of all on just, because in our culture, the whole idea of the husband being the head is just anathema, you know, to our culture. So let me comment on that for a second. All it really means in the final analysis is, you can picture it in the garden. Adam already has responsibility and has a direct, unmediated relationship with God. Unmediated. Nothing comes in between. God tells him what to do, and he hears it, and he's supposed to do it. So Adam has an unmediated relationship with God in the garden, and then God comes along later and says, I'm going to give you the gift of a helper. So Eve is given to him as a helper. What is her role? What is the purpose of her existence? To help him. He has an unmediated relationship with God. He has an unmediated role that is given to him by God. Her role is mediated by her husband. What do I do? Well, I help him with what he's supposed to do. So who he is and what his role is affects who she will be and what her role is, because her role is now mediated by this individual that she's married to. That's what it means to say that he's the head. You see, that's all that it means. Now, we have all kinds of cultural garbage that we pile on the top of that that doesn't belong there. But the one part that is just strictly biblical is that it has that kind of structure to it. So, look at the importance of that. We're trying to forge a life together as partners. You can't be partners with one going off this direction and one going off this direction. So if we're going to be partners together, we have to decide which direction are we going to go. Well, what if you're in a position where the husband feels conscience bound to make this choice, the wife feels conscience bound to make the opposite choice, and we're talking about conscience bound, a moral issue. What do you do? Fight it out? Arm wrestle? Thumb wrestle? You know, and see who wins? Or is it built into the very structure of the relationship? Would God come to the wife and say, yeah, your husband's kind of an idiot, but he is your husband? I'm not going to hold you accountable for a foolish choice. I'm not going to hold you as an individual accountable for a foolish choice that he makes if he refuses to listen to your wisdom. You're trying to help him because he's the head. So you're off the hook for, you know, if everything that you have done has been to try to lead him, encourage him, help him to respond to truth and wisdom and goodness, and he just refuses to go there, that's on him, that's not on you. Why? Because he has the unmediated role. Your role is to help him. So you've been trying to help him. If he refuses to listen to you, you've done everything you can. So I'm not being as clear as I can, but I think you can see that the woman has a certain freedom that the man does not have. The woman has the freedom to have the marriage make a mistake without her being individually responsible. The man doesn't have that freedom. If he makes a mistake, it's on him. So that's the kind of logic to the marriage relationship that you see, I think, in Genesis. Now, the problem we have with that is we have been sold a bunch of lies in our culture. And so our culture has tried to do everything it can to undermine the structure and the logic of that relationship. Now, granted, it's attacked a lot of abusive men who have been wicked and evil in their relationship to their wives. And of course, that's what, on the surface, it looks like what we are responding to are inhumane, evil jerks acting like little tin gods in their marriage relationships. And that's ugly and that's evil. Absolutely, that's ugly and that's evil. And there should be no room for it in human life. But do you throw out the headship of the husband in order to get rid of that? That's a huge mistake. And so what modern culture has done is actually undermined the biblical teaching itself in order to try to right this wrong, which was a very real wrong, I think. But look at the people who are telling us to throw that out. I mean, think long and hard about who these people are. They're becoming unmasked today. They're sexual, what's the word? Well, that too, yeah. What's the... harassers? Sexual harassment. They're men who use their power to try to bed women anytime they can. These are the ones that are speaking the loudest about, oh, I believe in equality, and, you know. So, they have the moral sensibilities of a banana slug. Why should I listen to them? Why should I learn from them? Why should they be the one teaching me about marriage and sexuality and that kind of stuff? They're being unmasked today, all over the place. So I think it's incumbent upon us to choose carefully who we're going to listen to. I mean, it comes back to what I started with Prager. What text do you guide your life by? What text do you believe that is from God that is worth you committing your life to ruling your life by that text? And that's just, I know it's not popular to believe in the headship of the husband, but it's what the Bible teaches. And I think it will manifest itself differently in modern culture than it did back then. No question about that. We don't have to become first century people to obey the Bible, but we do have to be wise and make sure that in our inward attitudes, in our inward spirit, in our inward orientation, that we're imitating these women and not the modern woman. But it's mostly an inwardness that makes the difference. It's not the outward things. That culture changes that. As culture changes, that's going to change. But the inwardness should be the same throughout all time. Anything else? Oh, I kept you late anyway. Thank you.